It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to this week's Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. This is Bill Corey, the sports editor at the Providence Journal. With me is Bill Koch, our Red Sox writer. Bill, you and I, we were burning the midnight oil last night, not together, of course, but the business of the NFL draft kept us busy, and obviously watching the Red Sox, which I did very little of, and you did more of. But the NFL draft was interesting here in New England and in Rhode Island in particular for a couple of reasons. Number one, the Patriots did something. They didn't trade out. They didn't trade down. They picked at their right. pick, and they got a quarterback of all players, which was a bit surprising that Mac Jones of Alabama was there at 15. But there he was, and they took him, and it could be an interesting and important pick for them.
Highest they've selected a quarterback since Drew Bledsoe, correct?
That's what I mean. That's what I'm reading today. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So definitely bring some drama to that quarterback room. They still obviously have Jared Stidham and Cam Newton, and Bill Belichick was quick to point out that Cam Newton is still the quarterback moving into the season. So we'll see how all that all plays out. A little closer to home, I guess, the wonderful story of Providence's own Quiddy Pay, who starred at Bishop Hendricken High School here in Rhode Island, got a scholarship to play football at Michigan. And last night, that dream of his to play professional football was realized when he was selected at number 21 in the first round by the Indianapolis Colts. And Bill, this is somebody you have a little bit of history with, because obviously you covered and still do at times high school sports here in the state. And Quiddy Pay was somebody that people took notice of when he played.
What a wonderful kid. What a great story. Couldn't be happier for Quiddy, his mom Agnes, his brother Comate. Just to think how much that family's life has changed.
So quickly.
From one generation to the next And you know, I wrote about this in the Journal earlier this week. For folks who don't know the story, his mom escaped a couple civil wars in West Africa, immigrated to the United States with her two sons. And her vision was to make a better life for them. Quiddy's promise to her when he got accepted into Hendricken was at some point he would get a college scholarship, and she would not have to pay for his education going forward. There wasn't necessarily any thinking that he would be a first-round pick in the NFL draft. That was so far into the future, you couldn't see it. But now that has been realized, I think the best part of last night was Quiddy in an interview with Maria Taylor on ABC telling his mom that she could retire.
Yeah, she's retired now. Yeah.
I think that's something that every son would like to tell his mother. Yep. We'd all like the ability to do that. Very few of us actually realize that dream and to watch it come true for him. And keeping in mind that he's such a wonderful kid on top of it, it was a great night. It was a proud night for sure.
And it was certainly a proud night for him and his family. And it was also, I would say, kind of a proud night for Rhode Island high school football too. We are not a football factory, but to have somebody who has starred here and played football in the Rhode Island Interscholastic League and then go on to become a force at a big time football school like Michigan and then get drafted first round in the NFL. I mean that certainly, I think, speaks well of the local competition. A big night all around. Lots of congrats to Quiddy, his mom, his family. And it'll be interesting and fun, I think, to watch him moving forward as his career progresses. Hopefully for a long time, with the rival Indianapolis Colts.
The crazy thing to think is, I like to think of myself as young, even though I'm not anymore. I'm on the wrong side of 40, as folks would say. But the crazy thing is to think, when I started out, there were two pros playing high school football in Rhode Island, Will Blackman and Jamie Silva. So you sort of get a sense of what special looks like, what different looks like. You know, both of those guys ended up playing at Boston College, and obviously Jamie won a Super Bowl with the Colts, and Will had a long career in the NFL as a defensive back. I think 12 years. And also ended up winning a Super Bowl as well with the Giants. But it's crazy to think that, considering how small a state we are, how few people we have, how little history we have in terms of professional athletes and football players specifically.
Yeah.
To see guys come out and have a chance to play in the NFL, it's wild to think, I knew him when or I saw him when. You're thinking, well, he's good. Like, he's special. He's really different. But you never quite know how good.
Right.
And then you see it validated like this, and you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, it's been a while. The last time, it was 1939 when there was somebody who was drafted in the first round, a Rhode Islander, Bill Osmanski, went to Central High School and then taken, and then played at Holy Cross and then taken by the Chicago Bears. And Quiddy truly is a Rhode Islander. I mean, he came here as an infant and grew up here. It's not the Paul Konerko of the Rhode Islanders who was born here and whisked away at a young age. He actually, he grew up here, and
we glom onto him as long as we can.
I understand how Rhode Islanders think too. They drive on 95 and they become Rhode Islanders.
We search for every connection we can find. this guy spent 5 minutes here once. We're claiming him because he's doing something good.
Right. It's funny. Well, having grown up in Fall River, people always thought I was a Rhode Islander because I had the accent and all that. But, I was quick to point, oh, no, I'm from Fall River. I'm not from Rhode Island, but pretty much I'm from Rhode Island.
So. I'm going to save my Fall River jokes because I value my job. And I don't want you to fire me.
And we'll do that after the podcast. So anyway, this is a baseball podcast. Last I checked,
yes.
So we have some interesting developments with the Red Sox in the last week. They are still in first place. If you're wondering, they are one of a handful of teams, maybe four teams, that have reached the 16 win mark at this point. They are still sitting on top of the American League East at 16-10. They dropped a game last night against the Texas Rangers, but had two kind of impressive wins prior to that against the New York Mets down at, Shea Stadium. It's Citi Field.
Yep.
Down in New York. And so I want to start by talking about their pitching and specifically about Garrett Richards, who... it's gotten off to kind of a rough start and then really put it together, and we hope it's a sign of things to come. Picked up his first win. I want to say it was Tuesday. And
yes, Tuesday night.
Seven innings. Gave up a home run but came away with the win. Scattered, seven hits. And really looked in command. Was locating his pitches, and there was a reason for this. I mean, other than him kind of focusing, there was a reason for this, wasn't there, Bill?
Changed his delivery, made a significant change in his windup with pitching coach Dave Bush. It was a lot less east to west and a lot more north to south. He took out a lot of extra movement in his windup that sort of got him going more downhill to the plate.
Yep.
Sort of kept him a little more contained. He was a little ungainly.
Yeah, before. He was kind of like, right, all elbows and knees and he's kind of a lanky guy and that stuff can get you kind of off rhythm very easily.
It's very difficult to find your timing and find your sink in your delivery when you're 6'4 or 6'5 and there are arms and legs going all over the place.
Right.
And, once you lose that little bit of timing, we're talking about Major League Baseball here. The margins for success are so fine.
Yep.
That if you lose even a little bit of your release point or a little bit of movement here or there, a tick or two of velocity, makes all the difference in the world. You go from someone who could be a good pitcher to someone who is an average pitcher or somebody who's out of the league.
Yeah.
Just those little degrees of good or great make a huge difference. And so for Garrett Richards to find a delivery that worked for him, to be able to find the strike zone, 10 strikeouts and no walks in that outing.
Yeah.
In a 2-1 victory over the Mets on Tuesday. Really encouraging because to this point, you would have said he's been the worst Red Sox starter. You know, he's been the guy who's sort of the anchor in the rotation, and not in a good way.
Right.
You know, and someone who they made a significant investment in the offseason. And, you know, to that, and we spoke to this on the podcast last week, he was someone who was going to be given a lot of leash, somebody who was going to be given a significant amount of starts to try and figure it out. Because they had invested so much.
Yeah, and $10 million for 1 year, right?
And you just couldn't have him pitching poorly, you know, over the course of what would have been, you know, maybe even the next 2 months, let's say.
Right.
You know, you're not going to designate him for assignment until you get to, like, June or July. Like, it would have been out there in the distance.
Yeah.
You know, so for him to find something that worked, to feel confident about it, and to see results immediately, I thought that was really encouraging.
It was very encouraging, and it was big at the moment, I think, or at the time, because you were staring at a Wednesday start or a Wednesday game against Jacob DeGrom.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jake DeGrom is one of the best, if not the best, pitchers in the game right now. So you wanted to get one under your belt, thinking, well, if we split this two-game series, no big deal. We're on the road. You want to at least go 500 here. But lo and behold, they figured out how to beat DeGrom in a very close game, a very well-executed game. They believe only got three hits, but they scored when they had the opportunity. And what is it with them and Jake DeGrom? They've been able to kind of beat him more than once here. You know, he's obviously one of the best in the game. The Red Sox just, I guess, have in recent matchups had his number.
They've had, he's had four starts against them. He hasn't won any of them. They took advantage of the one opportunity they really had in the second inning. Xander Bogaerts hits a leadoff double. Rafael Devers hits a shot to the right side, gets him over to third. Christian Vasquez doubles to right center. You know, even with that said, with one out, Vasquez hits the ball in the air. It would have been a sacrifice fly. So good situational baseball. And then DeGrom, I mean, just the reality for Jacob DeGrom is that the Mets don't score for him.
Right.
I mean, it's criminal the way they perform for that guy. Six innings, one run allowed. It's the 33rd time in his career he's gone at least six innings, allowed zero or one earned runs, and not gotten a victory. I mean, that's a crime. It's so bad. And the Mets offense right now, they are terrible. I mean, they're towards the bottom of the league in just about every statistical category. You know, Nick Pivetta went out. Five scoreless innings. Garrett Whitlock behind him, two scoreless innings. You know, and the Red Sox bullpen cleaned up behind.
Right.
You know, Adam Ottavino and Matt Barnes finishing up behind. You're right. That's sort of the bonus game. That's the one that you don't necessarily expect to win. You got Richards throwing very well the night before. You get a win in your pocket. You have at least a split in two-game series. You go out and beat Jacob DeGrom, and all of a sudden you've won three games in a row. The six-game road trip, you're 2-0. You only need one more win to split the road trip.
Right.
You know, that's sort of the bonus game that sets you up going forward into the weekend against the Rangers. That's the type of game that can really give you a lift.
As you have mentioned in our discussions in the past week here, they caught the Mets at a good time.
They did.
You know,
they really did.
They, you know, the Mets have some talent in that lineup. You just wouldn't know it right now.
No.
Lindor is really struggling. You know, who knows what the Mets are going to look like when they meet them again. I think they meet them August or September or something like that. But
September.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have two games at Fenway in September.
So it was good that you can jump on them when they're down because, hey, as you know, all the wins count the same and all the losses count the same. Doesn't matter when they come.
That's right.
So you brought up Adam Ottavino, Bill, and this is just a little side note. And it's a impromptu trivia quiz. You ready?
I'll try.
Okay. There's no way I would have gotten this because I looked it up. So Adam Ottavino wears the number zero.
Yes.
That is a number that only two Red Sox players have ever worn in the history of the game, or the history of the franchise, for Red Sox players. So, you know, it struck me as, you know, okay, he's wearing number zero, and Who else wore number zero? So I had to look it up. It wasn't somebody way back when. It was only in
the... I think
the,
I might have
in the year, like 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
I think I might have him.
Who?
Brandon Phillips.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow. That's very impressive. Brandon Phillips was on the team for... Was it even a full season, was it?
It was about 5 minutes at the end of 2018.
Right. I think he was like passing through Boston, so they said, hey, you know, come and play a few games or something.
What
so.
Brandon Phillips did was Brandon Phillips hit a winning home run
in an afternoon
game at
I remember
Atlanta,
that one.
A game that was completely bonkers from the start. Alex Cora had given just about all of his regulars the day off. It was a getaway day in Atlanta. I think it was a midweek game, like a Wednesday or Thursday. The Sox are down
early.
It was
a day game, right?
It was a day. It was like a 12:05 start.
Right.
Sox had nothing going on offense. They're down like 7-1 in the seventh inning. They end up coming all the way back, and Phillips hits a home run to left field that ultimately put them ahead.
Yeah.
That was his one contribution, really. He did not.
He was not on the postseason roster.
He didn't make the postseason roster, and I remember the workout day before the ALDS. At Fenway, they announced the roster. You went into the home clubhouse, and his locker had been cleaned out already. He was already long gone.
He knew.
he wasn't sticking around to cheer them on the bench.
That's right.
He was out of there. But yes, Brandon
that
Phillips.
That's very, very impressive. I would never have gotten up come up with Brandon Phillips because mainly I don't think I would remember he was even on the team.
No,
he was
really.
Only even there.
He was here for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't see too many number zeros in baseball.
No.
And certainly on the Red Sox. So when Ottavino walks out there, and it's kind of cool when you're a pitcher and you've got a zero because you want to give up zeros, right?
Oh, good. Yeah, good.
As a hitter, maybe not so much, you know, but...
No.
But, so it struck me and made me, check Google to see who else, and I was surprised there was only one other guy from the Red Sox.
Yeah.
Bill, one of the games, I forget which one it was. It was on ESPN, and I ended up watching the ESPN broadcast, not because I don't like the local broadcast. I very much do like the local broadcast, but I don't know. It just happened to be on ESPN that my TV happened to be on that channel, so I kept watching it. And one of the guys doing the game was Tim Kirkjian, obviously a longtime baseball scribe and now broadcaster. And he said something at the time during the game that kind of caught my ear, and that was they were talking about, you know, the Red Sox and this season and how well they are doing as of now, and if they could project forward, what do they see for the Red Sox this year? And I was very surprised by his answer because, you know, the Red Sox are essentially, 26 games into the season.
Right.
But he was very confident in saying that he feels the Red Sox are a playoff team. Now, you know, lots can happen between now and when these things are decided in August and September.
Sure.
Sometimes very late September. But for somebody like Kirkjian, who watches lots and lots of baseball and, you know, all the teams, for him to come out and say something like that, you know, for me, was eye-opening because as well as they're playing, I would certainly not kind of go out on a limb as of yet, but as we know, you know, math kind of takes over at some point.
That's right?
And you know, we're not quite there yet, but at some point, if you are below 500, it's a lot harder to get above 500 and surpass the teams that are ahead of you. So I guess it wasn't that crazy. I mean, you know, here we are on the doorstep of May, and if the Red Sox skid for five games and the, you know, whatever, the Blue Jays win five in a row or whatever, it's a whole different thing. But I don't know. What's your take on the Red Sox and playoffs? And I mean, because considering what they did last year, I think most of us were very conservative in our sort of prognostications. At least I was. And I thought, okay, well, they're probably going to do a little bit better than 500. You know, maybe they'll play, you know, they'll get to 82 wins or something like that. But, you know, they're on pace to do a lot more than that as of now.
Preseason, I said 85 wins. And, yep. And with the caveat that they could sell in July. you know, if they're not in playoff position or in a wild card spot.
Right.
They have a lot of guys who are going to go into free agency or who are on one-year deals with a club option for 2022, and you could return some value on the trade market with pieces like that. You know, so my caveat was if they are sellers, they'll win less than 85 games. Baseball Reference currently gives them about a 22% chance to make the postseason. I know before the year started that that was a single-digit percentage.
Wow.
You know, so that does reflect the math through 26 games,
yep.
The fact they're six games over 500. You know, whatever sort of pace they're on through, you can do the math over the next, you know, however many games that's going to be. I think you're right in saying that seasons hit a critical point. You hit a certain number of games over 500, and your chances are suddenly X instead of, you know, Y.
Right. And we're not there yet. I mean, they're five
close.
Or six games over 500. We're not there yet. But once you get to like 12, 13, 14 games over 500, it's a different deal.
For me, generally 20 is the number because that would make you a 91-win team at the end of the year.
Yep.
Most teams that win 90 games,
you get in.
In this wild card era, you're going to snag one of those spots. It would take a very unbalanced league you know, for the Red Sox to miss the playoffs with 90, 91, 92 wins. That essentially means that four or five teams are going to break away from the American League and win 95-plus. You know, and that's certainly possible.
Right.
But most years that just doesn't happen because what that requires is some teams on the bottom to be truly terrible. You're talking, you know, 50, 60 win teams on the other end. You know, a huge spread in the standings.
And the Red Sox took advantage of that in 18, and I forget what teams were. I think maybe it was Orioles or one of them or something.
Detroit was really bad. The Orioles were really bad. The Royals were really bad.
Right. You had three teams that you were going to play, and you should really win 90% of those games.
Well, and what the Red Sox did against the division that year, the Royals and the Blue, the Blue Jays and the Orioles, they just wore them out. You know, in 38 games against the two of them, they won more than 30. You know, just crushed those two teams at the bottom of the standings. I think they were 32-6. In the 38 games against those two. When you do something like that, you're just separating away. But for me, it's a math equation. If you're 20 games over 500 at some point, like let's say they get out to 53-33, just to use nice round numbers.
Right.
At that point, can you play 500 for 2.5 months? It's not unrealistic to think because you've just played 20 over.
Right.
You know, so for me, that's sort of critical mass. If you can get to 20 over, 15, 20 over, then you can start talking about, hey, we get a chance in October. The math lines up in our favor. Yep. It's pretty good. With all that said, you'd much rather be 16-10 than 10-16. And so for folks who are discussing playoff bids and trying to project things down the road, it's a nice conversation to have. I know Alex Cora brought this up the other day, pregame, the notion of power rankings.
Right.
And, you know, since we do a fair amount of college sports here at the Journal, I took a little interest in that. He was talking about where the Red Sox started the year. You know, they were in the 20s for most folks. You know, 20th, 21st, whatever it may be.
The ranking of all the teams, right?
Yes. From 1 to 30,
32 in football.
Correct. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, last week, they're in the top five, whether it's according to The Athletic or CBS Sports or ESPN. Happened awful quick in 4 weeks. You suddenly rise like that.
Right.
But they've turned it into sort of an inside joke in the clubhouse. You know, hey, I wonder where we're going to be this week, you know, in the rankings. Are we going to be, you know, number six? Are we going to be number four? You know, Cora has a college background. He played baseball at Miami. The Hurricanes were very good while he was there. They went to three College World Series. They played a national championship game.
Yep.
So he's not unfamiliar with the ranking system and how you can rise and fall and what sort of merits go into receiving votes.
Right.
You know, and I think it's just another one of these things that the Red Sox are using, whether it's the laundry cart or the waving or whatever else, that's adding a little character, a little chip, a little personality to their team to this point.
Well, hopefully we'll still be having these discussions about power rankings. But if you looked at the Red Sox offense this past week, it hasn't exactly been gleaming. Now, there's been a couple of, at least one standout moment to me, and that is Bobby Dalbec finally got his first home run down in Chase Stadium, and that was good to see. And hopefully this is maybe sparking a little bit of a streak for him. Kind of surprising that it took him this long, knowing how you know strong of a powerful of a hitter he is. But hopefully this is the first of many to come. Bill, how concerned should we be here with the Red Sox offense in the last few games? I mean, I think last night they only had like three hits or something like that. And even the games that they won, they haven't exactly pounded the other team. It was a 1-0 win against DeGrom. I forget what the score was when Garrett Richards was pitching.
2-1.
Yeah, but it was low scoring either way. And teams are going to go through this. You're going to have times when the offense is just not clicking. But I would say this is probably the first. Maybe the opening series against the Baltimore, they probably weren't pounding the ball either. I can't quite remember. But
no, they struggled. They were bad.
Right. Is it just sort of the ups and downs of the season and nothing to really worry about? Or are you seeing things that maybe rise to a higher concern?
No, they're a little cool right now. I think that's fair to say. You only had three hits on Thursday. Two of those were doubles by Alex Verdugo and by Rafael Devers.
Yep.
The encouraging thing I think you would say is their last five games they haven't necessarily hit and they still went 3-2. They would not have done that last year because their pitching was so bad.
Right. Right.
And there are going to be times where. Over the course of the year, you don't hit, and you need your starters to carry you a little bit.
Yep.
Sometimes that happens. For the Red Sox, it's happened this week, and that's a good thing.
But it's a good point. They have starters that can carry them this year.
Right now, it looks that way.
Yeah, yeah. But, you're looking at some of these as of late. Kiki Hernandez, I think, his on-base percentage is something like in the last 25 games, or in the 25 games he's played, is below .300.
Yep.
Below .300.
.271. Not great.
Not good for a leadoff hitter.
No.
Verdugo, who's got a .371 on base percentage, still not great. Still early. We're seeing ups and downs here. But in the old days, you're going back to maybe when Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz would anchor that lineup.
Oh, wait, if those are the old days, then really.
No, they're
they're
not the very old days. They're the medium old days.
Please.
How long ago was that now? That was probably 15 years ago, right?
Well, what I realized last night is that Mac Jones was born my sophomore year of college. So you want to talk about feeling old.
I've rounded that bend a long time ago. Yeah.
Oh, I almost started to cry.
Right, sure. Well, I remember watching the NFL draft when I was a teenager. And, all these people were older than me. And then I was about the same age. But then you're in your 20s, and you're like, yeah, we're kind of in the. And now, of course, they're the age of my children.
No, it's terrifying to think.
But
the lineup as a whole, Christian Vasquez had struggled a little bit until the double the other night against DeGrom.
Right.
Kike Hernandez has a .671 OPS, .271 on base. That's not ideal out of your leadoff guy.
Right.
Franchi Cordero and Hunter Renfro have been pretty much automatic outs.
Yeah.
To this point.
Yep.
They've really struggled. Marwin Gonzalez hasn't given you much. Bobby Dalbec has looked like a rookie at times. He should certainly be given more latitude because it is his first year. He is a good defensive first baseman.
Yep.
He's somebody that you hope will find it.
Sure.
And his power plays in just about any park. You knew strikeouts are going to be part of the deal. I guess what you need, based on all that, is you need Martinez, Bogarts, Devers to be elite.
Yeah.
It puts more pressure on those guys to carry your offense. You're not necessarily getting contributions from elsewhere like maybe you were during the 9-game winning streak where it seemed like everybody was doing something.
Sure.
Verdugo, I think, has been pretty good. He's got an .894 OPS. His average is up to .314. Last night, he hits double, he scores the only run in the sixth inning. You know, type of guy who just makes consistent hard contact. You know, going to all fields. He's third on their team in hits right now. You know, and looks solid batting in front of Martinez and Bogarts. Mm-hmm. I just think, though, that, you know, the lineup at the top, you don't necessarily have a great table setter in Hernandez. And the lineup at the bottom, you've got a lot of guys who are going to be automatic outs there. You know, and it's not necessarily as deep a group as you would like to have. And when Martinez or Bogarts or Devers inevitably have, you know, a stretch where they go 2 for 20 or something like that, I think you have a little less margin where other guys are going to be able to pick it up and drive you forward. You know, so in that respect, I think there is a little more pressure on those guys to do something night in and night out.
You know, and this should all be tempered by the fact that we're still, you know, 1 month into the season, and it doesn't take much to swing the average and the OPS, you know, significantly. You know, you have two or three really good games, and those numbers can jump pretty quickly. But, you know, just if you look back, they haven't been scoring a ton of runs and still figuring out a way to win, which is a great sign. But you want them to start scoring runs again. They're going to have to.
You know, I'm gonna look back to, you know, what I know you consider to be one of the most overlooked Red Sox teams among the champions, and that's 2007.
Yeah.
A team that you've described in this podcast before as a wagon.
Yeah.
Club that started off really well and just kept going.
Wire to wire.
You look at some of the offensive options in that lineup.
Yeah.
That lineup is a lot better than this lineup.
Of course.
The easy outs in that lineup were Jason Varitek and J.D. Drew, and they both had OPSs over 785.
Wow. Even Varitek, huh?
You had a ton of guys who were way over 800, whether it's Kevin Youkilis, Dustin Pedroia, Mike Lowell had an 879 OPS, Manny Ramirez was 881, David Ortiz was 1066.
Yeah,
there were so many guys who could hurt you in that group. It was the same thing in 2018. You had great depth in that lineup, and a lot of that had to do with Betts being at the top and then Martinez being in the middle and Bogarts emerging as an elite slugger.
Yep.
This group is a little thinner. Not as catalytic at the top and certainly nowhere near as deep going towards the bottom. And so I think, you know, when you have Bogarts have a tough night like he did on Thursday, you know, Martinez, who's battling migraines and should miss Friday's game, you're hoping that that's a short-term thing. If any of their performance slips a little bit, the other guys who they're trying to get by with are going to get exposed.
Right. And yet you, Bill, have been pointing out that teams that get off to the kind of start, like the Red Sox teams get off because of the kind of start that this team has, like 16 wins or whatever it is, you know, the last three teams have won World Series. So here you are putting undue pressure on the Red Sox early in the season.
That's all my fault. All my fault that they squeezed, that they only got three hits on Thursday, right? Yeah.
Well, it's an impressive stat, though. The teams have gotten, Red Sox teams have gotten off to this kind of start, have basically gone on to win the World Series. I mean, talk about pressure on that team. And I certainly don't think of this team as being as good as any of those teams. Not yet. I mean, as you just pointed out, I don't know if there isn't the depth in the lineup, but you know, who knows? We'll see. We'll see as we move ahead into the season. I don't want to leave the pitching completely far behind, before I bring up Garrett Whitlock, who's been really just aces for them, and who knew, right?
Right.
So this was a Rule 5 kid. Was this the Rule 5 guy?
Rule 5 pick from the Yankees.
From the Yanks.
Yes, and coming off Tommy John surgery.
Right, and in these, I want to say 13 innings or so far this year, has basically been, well, like perfect, I guess, or pretty close to it, right? I mean, he's given up 6 hits, no runs. He's struck out like 18 batters in 13 innings.
Yeah.
You know, he's one of those feel-good stories that came out of the spring that he got to, you know, he made the team. But he's been the real thing so far. It's been great to watch him.
Yeah, 2 scoreless innings the other night behind Pivetta on Wednesday. And, you know, this is the type of guy who, if you're high in Bloom, and if you're the scouting department with the Red Sox, you take a victory lap on this one. This this is the type of guy who you point to and you say, you want to question our decisions? Look what we did with Garrett Whitlock.
Right. And the fact that he came from the Yankees doesn't hurt either.
We stole him in broad daylight in the Rule 5 draft.
Right.
You know, Garrett Whitlock had never pitched above AA.
Yep.
Had Tommy John surgery, did not pitch at all in 2020, was not working out with the Yankees, you know, at their alternate site. He was rehabbing. You know, but this is a guy who has come in, and I think the thing I like most about Garrett Whitlock is that he works quick and throws strikes.
Yeah.
That says to me that he has a certain level of confidence, a certain level of belief in his stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that is the most important thing a pitcher can have, quite frankly, you know, aside from physical ability and command and whatever it may be. That belief that I'm just going to go out and I'm going to throw my pitches and I'm going to get outs and, you know, I'm just going to do my job. Like, that's the most important thing that anyone could have going out there.
And the defense really appreciates that, too, typically, when the pitcher goes out there, works quick. You know, it doesn't take these long rain delays between each pitch
kind of thing.
Walks around the mound or anything. He gets the ball and he throws the ball, you know. And you think of the really good, effective pitchers the Red Sox have had in recent years. You know, Chris Sale. And, you know, these guys tend to work pretty quick. Anyway, hopefully Garrett's season continues the way it's been going. It's been fun to watch. It's such a great story. You know, the fact that he was the Rule 5 pick coming from the Yankees doesn't hurt either.
Well, I know you particularly enjoy that.
I just want to see him beat the Yankees. Yeah. That's the ultimate thing, right? Bring him in at Yankee Stadium and have him sit down the side.
Well, considering that, you know, you wanted to bash the Yankees on last week's podcast, and then they went off and won 3 straight.
I know. That's why I had to do it then, because you know what was going to happen.
Clearly, they were listening to you, Bill Corey. You
right.
motivated them you know, to snap out of the doldrums there. You know, in Whitlock's case, though, the Red Sox, the way they're using him, I think, you know, folks should pay attention to the fact that he's had significant rest between his outings.
Yep.
At least 3 full days of rest between all of his appearances to date. And that's because they see him as a starter going forward. And the fact that he's still sort of fresh off Tommy John surgery, they want him to sort of stick to a regular throwing program. The temptation is, you know, move him into a higher leverage role, make him an 8th inning guy, make him a 7th inning guy, you know, make him the closer. Why not?
Right,
know, something along those lines. Either that or why don't we stretch him out and start him right now? I think they're taking a very conservative approach from a physical standpoint, and I think they feel like that will better serve him going forward. I certainly think that if he goes through a full season here, and has a sort of normal buildup to 2022, I think you could see them discuss him as a starter for next year.
Wow.
Whether that's whether that's developing him at first at AAA, or whether or not they give him a shot at one of the 5 spots in Boston's rotation to start next season. But I know that is the long-term goal for him, is to have him be a starting pitcher, and I think they've sort of tailored his workload accordingly here.
Well, they're not shying away from using him in high leverage situations, right? I mean, you know, he Cora has certainly shown confidence in him, and Whitlock has responded. You know, he's been as effective at any point when he's called upon. So, you know, I guess that wouldn't be surprising if they could keep him on the schedule and get him, you know, with the eye of getting him into the rotation next season. You know, kind of a nice bonus that I don't think anybody was really thinking about or even thought was a possibility.
No, I mean, he was a starter in the minor leagues. He made 42 appearances for the Yankees, and only 4 of those are out of the bullpen. He's a Rule 5 guy, so you want to keep him on the roster. You don't really have a choice you know, through the end of the season. So it turns into, what can we do with this guy that helps him and helps us? And they've settled on this multi-inning role. The other night, you know, it's a 1-0 game. It's in New York. It's a 6th inning. Pivetta is up over 80 pitches. You know, that's sort of the spot where you would see Whitlock come into a game, you know, regardless of the score. I think because he's pitched well, they were more comfortable using him. You know, but I also think that, it was his turn. You know, it was his spot.
Right.
He'd had enough rest.
Right.
You know, he'd thrown reasonably well enough coming into it. You know, hey, this is a spot we're going to use him. Let's see how much further he can walk out here onto the plank.
Right.
You know, we've already sort of nudged him out a little bit. Let's see if we can get him out a little further. And, you know, he lets a couple guys on in the sixth inning. He walks one. He gives up a hit, gets out of it. And then he comes out 1-2-3 in the seventh and,
yep.
and just buzzes through. And, you know, I think if I'm Garrett Whitlock, you know, it's the sort of thing where he's got it rolling right now. It couldn't be better
right.
for him than it is right now. You know, so why shouldn't he act that way? Why shouldn't he feel that way? You know, Matt Andrees was talking about him a little bit on Thursday pregame. And he said, yeah, he's had a lot of success early. And a lot of guys don't necessarily handle that very well. You know, they either try to do a little bit more or they get a little bit overconfident or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I feel like this kid has a really good head on his shoulders and is the type of guy who would be able to handle it. Cora pregame said that, you know, not only is Whitlock pitching well, but, you know, he can even perform the rookie duties well. He said he said he's perfect carrying the beer on the team charter. On top of it, you know. So
first things first, right?
First things first.
Right, you got to be able to do this.
Got to serve the veterans, you know. So I certainly think that, you know, he's carved himself out a nice role here. He's certainly performed well enough to earn it. And I think from a player development standpoint, a front office standpoint, that will be one of the storylines going forward that they will be most proud of.
Is one of the storylines that Andrees kind of showed him a changeup or taught him a pitch in spring training that he's using now? I think that was being discussed during one of the broadcasts. And that really amazes me that, you know, spring training's only a couple of months ago and, you know, teaches him a pitch and here he is throwing it in big league games against big league hitters and being effective with it.
Whitlock was, he did have a changeup previously. He's a fastball slider changeup guy, mostly fastball changeup. Andrees didn't necessarily change his grip, but he gave him a few mental cues. You know, keep your arm speed consistent. You know, you want to throw your two-seamer and your changeup out of the same tunnel, you know, so it's deceptive for hitters.
Right.
You know, you may want to think about using it in this count or against this type of hitter. You know, the sort of veteran things that Andrees can pass along, because he's been in the big leagues since, I think, 2014. So he's had instances where he's been a starter, he's been a reliever, he's been in high leverage spots.
He's a very versatile guy. It's one of those great guys to have in your bullpen because you can do a lot of things with him.
He's been a good signing so far.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, there is value in having veteran guys like that around to mentor younger guys when they come up who might do similar things to you. And and in his case, you know, Whitlock is throwing two-seam fastballs and change-ups. Andrees knows a lot about that, and any sort of knowledge that he can pass along, you know, is more than welcome. It would be similar to if you had a left-hander who's in the organization who's a fastball slider type.
Yep.
Who better to talk to than Chris Sale about being a fastball slider guy? You're not necessarily going to deliver it the same way. You're not going to have the same grip, but he can give you philosophical tips like, you know, on 2-1 against this guy, this is what I like to do. Or, you know, if you're missing, you know, up and away, you know, you might want to make this little change.
Right.
Or, you know, just
move to this side of the rubber or the mound or whatever. Right.
You know, just the sort of little tweaks that go on behind the scenes, just maybe little verbal or mental cues that go on behind the scenes that we might not necessarily notice. But like I mentioned at the start of the podcast, there are little degrees here that separate the good from the really good, the good from guys who are out of the league 5 minutes later. And if Andrees can give Garrett Whitlock even an extra percent or two in terms of his ability to succeed, makes a huge difference.
You brought up Chris Sale, so I'm going to ask the question, what's the latest news on him? I know that they say that they were saying he's getting close to taking the mound or pitching from the mound. Has that happened or is that going to happen soon? What have we heard lately about Chris Sale?
He is in Fort Myers. He traveled on Sunday. He was playing long toss at Fenway Park before that, out to 135 feet. Generally, if you are extending your long toss, you will start throwing on flat ground. And then once that happens, you will transition to the mound. And I would imagine that Chris Sale will be off the mound at some point in May. I think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, he is 13 months removed from Tommy John surgery. I think today, actually, is his anniversary. I think it was March 30th of last year. He's 13 months removed. The recovery time is usually 12 to 15 months. So he's right in the window in terms of when he would start to be aggressive. They felt like he made some really good progress in Boston over the first month of the season. You know, him going to Fort Myers gives him the opportunity not only to work with the medical staff, you know, not only to sort of utilize the whole training facility there, but he can throw in simulated games against minor leaguers who are working out there.
Yep.
He can get live game situations there, whether it's batting practice, simulated inning, whatever it may be. You know, once he gets up and he's off the mound and he's throwing a little bit and he builds up his pitch count a little bit, then he can sort of get into what he needs to get into to really consider a comeback here. You know, I still think he's a few months away. I mentioned on a previous podcast, I think August 1st is probably a good target date
yep.
for him, even though they're not commenting on a time frame. You know, but he is progressing. They feel good about where he's at this point. It does seem like he has taken some steps forward since the first of the year.
Well, I know most Red Sox fans are rooting for him because what a great midseason acquisition if he comes back and can be effective and can resemble the Chris Sale that he was a few seasons ago. And if the Red Sox are still on that path to the playoffs or, you know, above 500, you know, having somebody like Chris Sale come back in and kind of help anchor that line, that pitching rotation, boy, that would go such a long way. It's so hard to know, though, with, you know, Tommy John surgery and recovering and kind of getting your stuff back. It usually takes a while. You know, it's like kind of a year and a half kind of thing before you are back to sort of normal.
I think the hardest thing about it is that, you know, a lot of times, whether it's Tommy John recovery or an ACL recovery, it's not linear.
Yeah,
you're going to have some setbacks.
Right.
You know, every human body is different. Mm-hmm. They're going to react differently to, you know, whatever sets of exercises, you know, whatever sort of strain you put on it in the rehab process. And so it's not linear. You have some sort of checkpoints. You have some benchmarks that you'd like to reach, but people reach them at different times. You know, I think back to, like, in the NFL, I think Adrian Peterson tore his ACL and was back in 9 months, something along those lines.
Right,
and then the next year had one of his best seasons of his career. And you're looking at it and you're thinking, 9 months, how?
How did he do that?
Yeah, you know, how does that happen?
Yeah.
You know, I consider Adrian Peterson to be the modern Jim Brown, you know, in terms of physical stature, running style, degrees of greatness. You know, so maybe he just is the bionic man. You know, in terms of Sale, you're looking at him and he's 13 months out, and there would be some guys who would have already started a rehab assignment or already would, you know, be closer to pitching in games. He had two setbacks. He had some neck stiffness that set him back, and then he had COVID-19 in January, which set him back. And when you're trying to project out rehab, whether it's over, you know, 12, 14, 15 months, you can set the benchmarks, you can set workouts, you can say in month 13, this is what you're going to do at the start. But I would imagine it's sort of like planning a wedding. Like at some point, a vendor's going to drop out or there's going to be a price increase on something that you didn't anticipate or, you know, you're not going to be able to monogram the napkins and you think, oh, my God, you know, what are we going to do?
The cake is how much?
Right. You know, and that's over the course of a year or however many months. And you think about, I have not planned a wedding. You have.
Well,
you know, this.
My lovely bride did most of the planning, fortunately.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
But
I had one job and I did it. So.
But I'm sure you heard all about it and all of the, you know, all the arrangements that went into the day. And, you know, all the careful details that Claudine, you know, so meticulously went over, I'm sure, you know, to make it special and make it memorable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that takes a long time and a lot of attention. And a lot of those things are just on paper. You're not dealing with a human body.
Right.
And
right.
so when you have Chris Sale and you think, oh, well, yeah, here's this timeline, 12 to 15 months, and we're going to do this in month 8 and this in month 9, it's not always that cut and dry.
Well, hopefully August 1st comes around and we're all dancing at the wedding, so to speak, right?
That's right.
Hopefully he does make that return. You know, August 1st is a significant date for another reason.
And oh, that's right.
That is because it's not my wedding anniversary, if that's what you're thinking, Bill. But
you better know what day that is, by the way.
I do.
All right, good.
I do, and it's not that.
Good.
In Massachusetts, Governor Baker has said that by August 1st that Fenway Park and most venues should be back to full capacity.
Yes.
Which is great news.
Yes.
I think it shows that the numbers are going in the right way. I think it shows that the vaccines are getting they're out there. More and more of the population has the vaccine. I think we are kind of steamrolling back towards normalcy. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to not have any masks in any situation, but I think that for the most part, we can kind of congregate and go to ball games and concerts and clubs and restaurants and things like that again. And I obviously know that there's a lot of restaurant owners that are waiting desperately for that day to come back because they've certainly been hammered.
Yes.
But that is a good sign. Let's hope that, in fact, it is August 1st, if not even sooner. I know the governor was dropping hints, I think today or yesterday, that it may happen even sooner. You know, obviously, it's a function of numbers and how well we've got the pandemic under control. But, you know, Bill, when we all went home from the office about a little over a year ago.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but there was no way that I would have envisioned us having the year that we've had, staying out of the office and away from people, and it's just so gratifying and encouraging that we are seem to be anyway kind of on the doorstep of just about normalcy.
I'm just happy that I can hug my mom again.
Yeah,
and not sure. Have to worry about getting her sick.
Right.
I'm happy that I can hug my nephew and play with him.
How old is he now?
He's 11 months.
Wow.
You know, he'll be a year in late May.
Yeah.
You know, it's just little things like that. You know, I've had my second shot. I'll be fully immune next Wednesday.
Great.
I can't wait to go to a bar and just order a beer.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
it's just those little things that we haven't been able to do in forever.
You know, not have to worry about getting COVID.
Yep.
You know, and I think that... You know, folks lowering, you know, folks rescinding those guidelines and sort of, you know, raising those capacity limits in stadiums, you know, whether it's for sporting events, concerts, whatever it may be. Those obviously reflect vaccination rates. They obviously reflect progress that we've made as a whole. You know, and they are going to reflect a celebration in this country, I think. I really believe that. Once you get to that point where Fenway Park is open and Gillette Stadium is open and you have the Red Sox and the Patriots and concerts and whatever it may be, I can't wait to see what the atmospheres of those are going to be like. I cannot wait. I think you'll probably have some hiccups early. You're going to have some masking, I would think, at those events, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
You know, but I certainly cannot wait for that first night that there's a sold-out Fenway Park. You know, August 1st, the capacity deadlines are lifted. The Red Sox first home game would be August 10th.
Okay, so they're on the road.
Against Tampa. They are on the road. Yeah. They play Tampa, Detroit, and Toronto.
Yeah.
Their first home game back would be August 10th.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the first event at Fenway would be a concert. I know Guns N' Roses was scheduled to play August 3rd. Billy Joel is scheduled for August 4th. I have tickets nice. For that one.
For Billy Joel?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's sort of been a date. They rescheduled that from last year. I've had tickets for it. That's sort of been like the light in the future that
that's
I've
great.
Looked at.
Yeah.
You know, over the course of the last year, you know, when they rescheduled the show last May and they announced, you know, the tour is going to be off and we're going to reschedule the dates for next year.
Yeah.
And they said August 4th. And it's, you know, they're spitballing the date. The Red Sox
right.
are away. It's in the summer.
Right.
Who
That's
knows?
When it's available.
They're
right.
guessing. But you're watching the vaccine play out. You're watching the virus play out and the timelines play out. and the progress that we're making, whether it's lowering infections, lowering hospitalizations, increasing vaccine numbers, and you're looking at it and you're trying to sync it up on the two tracks.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, okay, when is this going to happen?
Right.
Is August 4th really going to happen? Is it realistic? Is it a night that I can actually start to get a little excited for?
Sure.
And you're waiting for government officials to reach that point where they are comfortable, where the vaccine numbers are at a certain point, or the availability is at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And they can say, yes, we're going to open these venues, and you can come out into the streets, and you can celebrate this sort of thing, and get together with folks, and you know, just sit in a bar and talk about sports, or you know, just go to a concert and enjoy, you know, greatness from someone like Billy Joel or Dave Matthews or mm-hmm. you know, whoever it may be. I can't wait for it, and I'm so excited that it's starting to become a reality, that you can get more and more optimistic about it, because for so long in this industry and everywhere else, all we were writing about was postponements, rescheduling, things that weren't going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm so excited to write about things and talk about things that will happen again.
Absolutely. No, well said. Well said. And yeah, August 1st can't come soon enough. I've got a daughter who is going to be graduating from college in Massachusetts, and her graduation is not going to be on the campus, but is going to be at Gillette Stadium now.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, and it's going to be at the end of July, so it's not going to quite be when everything is opened up, but they are certainly letting a certain number of family members go. So we are absolutely looking forward.
This is Bridgewater State daughter?
This is my
correct?
Bridgewater State daughter, right,
yep.
Right. Graduating with a degree in education.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, let's hope that all of those things that the high school seniors and the college seniors and students that have been they've been missing out on can kind of return in some form here.
Well, in along those lines, Fenway Park is opening up for city high schools to graduate.
Yeah, I just saw that, which is great. That's fantastic.
Which is awesome.
You know, and we're looking forward to being at Gillette Stadium because, you
absolutely.
Know, Bridgewater State is a beautiful campus. It would have been wonderful. But the fact that you're going to have it at the home of the Patriots in that beautiful big stadium, it kind of gives it a little bit of extra oomph, you know. So we're looking forward to that. And then I'm sure graduating, high school graduation at Fenway Park, you're not going to forget that.
Well, it's just so unique. It's such a story that,
sure.
that you'll tell for the rest of your life.
Yep.
You know, and it's born out of really terrible circumstances. You'd much rather
absolutely.
Have it conventional, and you'd much rather have it to the point where you know, we didn't have to go through all this, and that we didn't have to live, you know, the last 13 months and ultimately
right.
the last year and a half. You know, nobody wants this again, and you know, we're going to look back on it. It's going to be a challenge and something that, you know, we talk about in solemn tones. You know, but to come out of it with something like a graduation at Gillette Stadium or at Fenway Park where you can tell your kids and your grandkids, hey, you know, it was sort of tough times while, you know, I was going
yeah.
through that, and we tried to make the most of it.
Sure.
And this is what we did.
Yeah.
We did something that nobody else has done.
Yeah.
And that nobody else will do. It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. 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 I mean, it's certainly been a long and difficult road with the number of people that have been lost to the pandemic. It's great that we can get to a point now where society can kind of feel safe and start resuming some normal activities. And hopefully we don't go backwards. So, Bill, here we are again, knocking on the door of an hour. It's amazing how time flies when you're talking Red Sox and other things. So the Sox, just to do some housekeeping here, are wrapping up their series down in Texas this weekend.
Yes.
They play tonight, Friday. They play tomorrow, Saturday night, and they've got a Sunday afternoon game.
Correct.
And then they come back and they see the Tigers and the Orioles. And is that it?
Tigers home
yep.
at the Orioles for four.
Oh, at the Orioles. I'm sorry. You're
over
right.
the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. So it was a quick homestand with the Tigers.
Quick three games at home with
yep.
the Tigers. Yep. After a Monday off, which I'm sure they will appreciate.
That's right. as will you.
Sure.
And then they go to Baltimore and they come back to host the Oakland A's. So we will be keeping tabs as usual. Bill, it's a beautiful, well, it was a beautiful day. A little windy, but it's not too bad out there. So
warm day. Feels good.
Yeah, so we can get out there and enjoy it a little bit. And we will check back in a week and see where our Red Sox are doing, what they're doing. Bill, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.